of the early church, a study of Christianity from the first through the fourth centuries. Now, you're studying the Bible. So you've been studying, you know, the New Testament as part of your studies, which is the New Testament church. We're going to go through the fourth century. You know, the New Testament covers only about 100 years. So you have 100 years history there. That's the church. And when we think about the church and church history, we always go through that 100 years. Why would we talk about what happened for the next between 200 and 300 years after the Bible? Why would we even talk about that? Why would we cover it? I mean, most of you probably don't know much about that time period. Yes, why?
To see how Christianity developed, I guess, and how how mainstream Christianity developed, I guess we could say.
Christianity went through an enormous change. It's still changing, by the way. If you were a conservative Protestant, say 40, 50 years ago, a Methodist, Church of Christ, Baptist, and you went into a church today, many people wouldn't even recognize it as Christian anymore. It continually evolves and changes. Sociologists talk about the Western world now. You know how they have periods of time, the Reformation, the Industrial Age. This is now called the post-Christian age in the Western world. The Christianity is changing so much that it's not even recognizable to people who used to be Christians. When we look through this period of time, we're going to begin to understand what happened to Christianity. Now, you all have a textbook, because there's so much material, and I'm doing a bit of an informational dump here in this week. There's a lot of information. As far as they'll say, oh, there's a test. How am I ever going to remember all this? I'm going to make it fairly simple. Every time I show a slide, if you see something bold, it's on the test. Okay? So I'm going to tell you ahead of time what's on the test. Because all I want you to do is get a little bit of a picture of what happened. Now you think, okay, we're going to jump into the second century. No, we're not. We're going to spend half of our time going through this from a historical viewpoint. Now, you've been studying the Bible from a theological viewpoint. We're going to look through the Bible and the history of what happened to lead up to the church, and then what happened, the history of what happened for a couple hundred years after the death of John. Because there's a number of things that are very interesting. When you start with Jesus Christ, he says, I've come to found the church, right? Have you already taken the Gospels? Okay, if you've taken the Gospels and you've done part of the book of Acts, then part of this, you know, you're going to have links to part of what we're going to talk about. So, Jesus starts a church, and it's a very simple church. It's basically made up of Jews. They're seen as a sect of Judaism. And they're seen as a sect of Judaism for decades, even by the Romans. But it begins to change. And they have all kinds of problems. We'll talk about the problems they had in the first century. How fragmented, how many problems did they have in the first century? So we tend to think of all the New Testament was the singular church and everything was perfect. And it was the golden age. Wouldn't it be great to be part of the church in the first century? Well, yes, but it wasn't perfect either. And the proof of that is the last book of the Bible. In Revelation, we have a letter written to seven literal churches. Now, we know Revelation 2 and 3 has a prophetic meaning to it, but it was literally written to seven churches. And those seven churches were in Asia Minor, Ephesus, Smyrna, you know, Laodicea, Thyatira, Pergamos, Philadelphia. And that area is now Turkey. Okay, that's the area of Turkey on a map. Here. Okay. This is Greece here. This is Turkey. And what's interesting, if you read Revelation 2 and 3, all seven of those churches are different. They're dramatically different than each other. In fact, five out of the seven are reprimanded for not following true Christianity at one form or another. All the apostles but John were dead when that was written in 95 AD. There was no longer a headquarters church. We'll go through what happened there. And the church had fragmented. And there's a lot of reasons why it fragmented. The fragmentation continues in the second and third centuries. And when you get at the beginning of the fourth century, there's an attempt to bring order out of Christian chaos. When we go through what developed in the second and third centuries, you're going to say, people actually believe that? And we'll show at the end that there are Christian churches today that believe all the weird things, all the different things we come up with. You're going to find some church, someplace that believes it. And what happened at the beginning of the fourth century, in the early 300s, there was an attempt to bring order out of the chaos by forming a universal or Catholic church. And that's the first time you have the term Catholic church used. We must create a central church to stop the chaos, to stop the fact that by this time there are hundreds of Christianities. To understand why you and I are a minority in Christianity, right? Well, we're sort of a minority in Christianity. That's true. What we are is an attempt to go back to the first century and follow the teachings of the first century Christians in a modern culture. We have a real difficult issue we're dealing with here. We're trying to go back to the first century and say, what were the teachings of the first century Christians, and put that into a modern culture. The problem, even the first century Christians argued over things. Right? Every letter of Paul is written to some church that he's saying, you got something wrong. 1 Corinthians is a church you and I would walk out of. I mean, Corinthian church, if you read 1 Corinthians. It's a church you and I would walk out of. We wouldn't even stay in that church. It was a church of God. We have people trying to force people to be circumcised. And it makes perfect sense why you should be circumcised if you have the Old Testament. Do we believe in the Old Testament? Yes. Why aren't we circumcised? There's all these issues. They were arguing issues in the first century. But they stayed together somewhat. And then a series of events happened, what we'll go through, the divided Christianity, and there's a reason it got divided. And then there was an attempt to create unity through the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church in the Middle Ages had enough power that they created unity by killing anyone who didn't agree with them. You're unified, right? Even if you don't believe, you're going to say, yes, I do, because you don't want to get killed. You actually have a Christianity that enforces people the way Islam in the radical countries, they believe in radical Islam, the way they do it. You don't believe what we're telling you, we'll kill you. That's the way Christianity became. How did that happen? And that's what we're going to talk about. Now remember, we're going to go through this from a historian's viewpoint. Please feel free to ask questions. In fact, every once in a while, I'm going to take a little break and say, okay, questions or discussion. Like I said, some of this is going to be brand new, and it can be a bit overwhelming. That's why you have a textbook. Okay? You have a textbook so you can study through it. Someone asks me every year, someone says, can I bring the textbook to the test? Or yes, you can bring your Bible to the test. I want you to be able to find the information. The important thing is to find, know where I can find the information, not memorize all the information. I don't have all this memorized either. Okay? But we have to be able to find it. As a historian, when we look at history, the first thing we look for are original sources. What does that mean? Anybody have an idea what an original source is? If, somebody have an idea? Huh? Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say like a primary source, someone that saw something happen or heard something happen firsthand.
A primary source in which someone saw something firsthand. Let me give you an example. If you really want to become a student of the Bible, you can read 50 commentaries and 50 Bible dictionaries. But you will never be a student of the Bible until you do what? Read the Bible. This is the original source. This is the primary source. So yes, we have lots of history books that we should study, but we always try to use as many primary sources as possible. So Let's look at a couple primary sources. Philo. Notice that Philo is bold, okay? You say, well, Philo, I've never heard of Philo before. Most people haven't. But Philo had an impact on Christianity because he had an impact on the formation of parts of first century Judaism. Now, when I talk about Judaism, there were many branches of Judaism. Now, you know that because you've heard of Pharisees and Sadducees, right? Just like when we talk about Christians, there's many branches of Christians. Philo was a Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, and he wrote a huge book, which you have a copy back in the library. I have a copy at home. There's probably, you can get it online. I wouldn't recommend you go buy it. You know, I have, of course, you walk into my office, there's like 1,200 books. So, you know, it's old. I had someone come into my, he was about 24 years old, come into my office recently, and he said, wow, it's like a, this place is just filled with old man's antiques. I said, son, those are called books. Okay, books, that's what those are. Philo took Greek philosophy and the Bible and mixed them together. Now, that sounds strange, but what we're going to find is this was common in the Judaic world, and it was common in early Christianity, and we'll have to know why. Because you actually live in a world that's very Greek. Greek society came into the Roman Empire and into the United States. And there are certain things that we do, there are certain concepts we have, they're actually Greek. They come from the ancient Greeks. So Philo is very important because of that. And he taught that the Bible should be seen as an allegory. You didn't take everything literally. It should be read as an allegory. What's an allegory? Anybody know what an allegory is? Yes. Story with a double meaning. Okay. Now we know there are allegories in the Bible, by the way. But there's something different than saying the Bible is literal. You know, when you at ABC, we are considered fundamentalists in the Christian world because we teach the Bible as literal that contains some allegories. Now, that's a totally different approach than the Bible is an allegory that contains some literal. You understand the difference? We believe it's literal. Now, there's some allegories in it too. So we see types. Ancient Israel leaving Egypt is a type of us leaving sin. And you can find that in the Bible. Now, but we believe they actually left Egypt. We believe this Red Sea actually opened. If you see it as an allegory, you'd say, well, that's all just made up. That's just a story to teach us something. It really never happened. And there are very many people that are Christians that see the Bible as an allegory. So we don't. We see it as literal. This is important because he influenced the development of Judaism in the first century because he took Greek philosophy, looked at the Bible, and created this enormous commentary on the Scripture that you can get today. It's been translated in English. Second person is Flavius Josephus. Flavius Josephus is famous for two books, The Jewish Wars and The Jewish Antiquities, both of which are in the library. And both of which are online. You can get them online. Once again, unless you have a real, real interest, if you're going to buy a book, I would suppose this would be it. You can, that helps study, understand some of the first century. Flavius Josephus has a mixed reputation in the Jewish world. And the reason why is he was a leader of the Jewish revolt against the Romans. When they revolted against the Romans in 67 AD, he was captured by the Romans and taken to Rome. And he saw how mighty, you know, he saw the might of Rome. I mean, Rome was huge. Rome was rich. It was beyond his imagination. He came back and tried to convince everybody to surrender. We can't beat these people. It doesn't matter. They're too huge. And so he's seen as a traitor by, you know, even some Jews today. He saw himself as trying to save them. We all have another first century. Now, there's just a handful, but to show you, these are very famous first century sources. Tacitus, he was a Roman historian. He wrote the Annals of Imperial Rome. The reason why his book is so important, he also wrote a book on Germania. It was about the German barbarians, which is it's a very fascinating book. But the Annals of Imperial Rome is very important because it tells us about Roman history, which is important, but it does something else. He mentions Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate doesn't show up in very many Roman records. The reason why is, to be sent to Judea meant your political career was over. Because when you were sent to Judea, it meant you were going to have all kinds... Excuse me, I have allergies, so it looks like I'm crying, but I'm not. When you were sent to Judea, it meant that was the backwater. I mean, when you were sent there, it's like, oh no, those are just troublemakers. You're sent to the Jews, they're nothing but troublemakers. Okay? And so Pontius Pilate doesn't show up much. Tacitus, who gives us one of the greatest of the Roman historians, tells us about Pontius Pilate being there and killing this Christ, this Messiah guy, and he killed him. So what we have is a historical source that's considered by all historians to be the greatest historical source of the time, Roman historical source, and he tells us that Pontius Pilate not only existed, that's in the Bible, but Jesus Christ existed. There are some people who claim that there's no proof that Jesus existed outside the Bible. There's all kinds of proof he existed outside the Bible. And this is a very important one here. And then one more is Suetonius. Suetonius was an imperial secretary under Emperor Hadrian in the second century. But because of this secretary, he helped did paperwork and so forth for the emperor. He had access to all these Roman records. He took those Roman records and he created the Lives of the 12 Caesars. We know about Nero. We know more about Claudius and all these, these insane, I mean, some of these Caligula, these were insane Roman emperors. Claudius wasn't so bad. But we know about them because the secretary took all the notes and records and wrote a biography of the 12 Caesars. And that has been passed down and exists today. These four sources alone tell us a lot about the world in which the church came along in the first century. Now, before we can get into the second century, we have to go through the three cultures that existed, that mixed together at the time of the church, both in Judea and wherever Paul went. Paul went throughout the Roman Empire. So, first of all, let's look at the very first culture that we need to talk about by go in your book to page 20 and 21. And you will see something that you've been studying, right? You've already gone through the Torah, right? You've gone through the major, minor prophets. Have you been through that? You've already been through the history, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. Okay, that's all this is. These are sort of the highlights, okay? But think of yourself. Here's the thing about history. You put yourself and you imagine yourself as a person living during that time. It moves from an intellectual exercise into, I'm a person living then. I get sandals on, I have, if you're guys, you're wearing a toga. Well, no, it wasn't a toga, but it was like a toga. Okay. You weren't wearing pants, by the way. Real men didn't wear pants in the Roman world. In fact, one of the things that the Romans decided the Germans were such barbarians, they wore pants. What kind of man would wear pants? Just barbarians. Real men didn't wear pants. Things change over years, right? One of the things that German barbarians have left in our society are a number of things. One is you and I wear pants. Okay, you can thank the German barbarians for that. But you look at the world in which the Jews lived in. If you were a Jew in the first century and you came in contact with Jesus, This history was your history. Your history was longer than the Greek history. Your history was much longer than the Roman history. In fact, the Romans looked up to the Jews in one way because they'd been around so long. You people have been here and you have such a history. So if you were a Jew in the first century, what do you say? I am a descendant of Abraham. That's my identity. Remember Jesus saying, don't just say you're a descendant of Abraham. I can make descendants, or God can make descendants of Abraham out of rocks. Why would he make that? What a stupid statement, right? No. That was your identity. That's who you are. And it governs everything in your life. I am a descendant of Abraham, and all the rest of you people aren't. You are Gentiles. You're other people. There's us people and other people. There's only two classes of people in the world. Descendants of Abraham and people that weren't descendants of Abraham in their mind. So Paul comes along and says, no, spiritually we're all descendants of Abraham. And a lot of Jews got a little bit offended by that. So you're a descendant of Abraham. You are a descendant of Moses. And God brought Israel out of Egypt through all this power and destroyed the great superpower on the earth at that time. Absolutely destroyed Egypt. Opened the Red Sea. This is your history. This is the history that you live every day. You know, you and I are Americans. You go to another country and it's like, well, what happened to my American history? They don't care. Of course they don't. If you go to France, they care about their French history. Right? I went to France a couple years ago, and the first sermon I got, I said, I want to thank all of you, because in the American Revolution, we were losing. And the reason, one of the main reasons we won is the French sent over an entire fleet and thousands of soldiers that helped us. In fact, in the last great, in Yorktown, there were probably almost as many French soldiers as American soldiers fighting there. I said, thank you for doing that for us. And people came up and cried and said, no Americans even acknowledged that to us before. So, well, yeah, that's why we showed up in the First World War and saved your bacon, right? Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we're just returning the favor here. But see, right? We live in our culture. We think it's normal. Put yourself in the mind of a first century Jew, because all the first Christians were Jews. Then you have, their history goes through Joshua and Judges, the kings. All of the prophets, up to Malachi. And then there was a history between Malachi and the first century. And we're going to have to go through that to understand what it's like to be a Jew. But I want to step back to something, because there's something that had a profound effect on Judah. Remember, the 10 tribes got taken off and sort of lost. I mean, they got gobbled up by the Assyrians and taken off. The Jews, along with Benjamin and Levi, got taken into captivity by the Babylonians. And they went to Babylon. Now, this is the time of Daniel. You took Daniel, right? Have you taken Daniel? So you know a little bit about Persian. Okay. They're taken off into Babylon. Something happens to them because they're told they're going to go back. So during the Babylonian captivity, they began to say, what do we have to do to make sure we don't get put back into captivity? I mean, someday we're going back. When we do, how do we protect ourselves? So during the Babylonian captivity, the study of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, became absolutely central to Judaism. Now, the rest of the Old Testament was important too, but nothing was like that. Why? Think about it. If you're in captivity because you disobeyed God, what's in the Torah? What's in the Torah? The law. If I can know the law perfectly, whenever we go back, we'll never go into captivity again. So what do I must do? I must protect the law. So there arose, there had already been in Judaism, a lot of oral laws. The reason why is the way that the Jewish society is. They discuss and argue and debate everything. So what they did is they would debate everything. and you would go to a rabbi, and a rabbi would gather his disciples around, and they would debate as he taught them. You know, you think Jesus walking through Judea with 12 men with him, we see that if we saw 12 guys all sort of dressed the same walking down the street today, we'd say, man, it must be a gang, right? That's not what they thought. It was normal. Oh, there goes the Jesus' debate society. They followed Jesus, and he taught them. And his disciples, they were imitators of him. That's what it meant. To be a disciple wasn't a student, it was an imitator. So they're following him around, imitating him. So they began to take all the arguments and sort of pass them on orally. Well, Rabbi so-and-so said this. Rabbi so-and-so said this. Well, 300 years ago, Rabbi so-and-so said this. They even started to write it down. I think it's about 32 volumes called the Talmud. Okay, it's the arguments. We've got to write down all the arguments. Because this is how we remember things. This is how we learn. So this became known as the oral law. So the two core things in Judaism was the Torah, the law, if we understand the law, and the oral law. Because the oral law protected the law. If I keep the oral law, I can't break the real law. So they're taken out of captivity, right? Out of Babylon, and they, because the Persians take over, right? Persians take over, and they send, Cyrus sends them back. Remember that from your Daniel class. So he sends them back. But not all the Jews go back. This is very important to understand if we're going to understand how the church grew in the first century. Many of the Jews had been scattered throughout the Babylonian Empire and then just sort of scattered throughout the Persian Empire. And it's called diaspora, the dispersion. Okay? They get sent all over the place, or they move all over the place. They all don't go back. Some go back and they reestablish Judah. But you have the diaspora, the dispersion. You'll see that word all the time in Jewish history. And in the dispersion, every place they go, they end up in cities and towns. The Jews aren't, as far as the when they're scattered, they're not agricultural people like they are when they end up in Judea. They end up in towns. And in towns, they create communities, and they become business communities. The Jews become famous as merchants and bankers. As merchants and bankers. And they create these communities, and every time a community gets large enough, they create a synagogue, which we would call church building today. But when they create a synagogue, this was a place for prayer. It's where you studied the Hebrew Scriptures, because as soon as you got a synagogue, you would send off and get a rabbi sent there, which was like a pastor. And the rabbi would come and teach the Hebrew Scriptures. And it was their social activities. Everything was centered around a synagogue. That's the ruins there of an ancient synagogue from about the first century. So all over now what you know had been the Babylonian Empire, spreading out through the Persian Empire, and spreading out through the Greek Empire, and spreading out through the Roman Empire, every major city practically ended up with a synagogue, with a Jewish community and the Jewish Scriptures. And this is going to be very, very important when we go through and study. Now, let's go back to the Torah and the oral law for a minute. Because in these synagogues, remember, the average person doesn't have a Bible. We're going to find that real problem in the second and third centuries. You can't afford a Bible. They're just way expensive. You and I take Bibles for granted. The average person couldn't have a Bible. Many times the average church only had part of a Bible. So your viewpoint of Christianity is going to be fragmented because you don't have a whole Bible. But the Jews had these synagogues, and there they had the Old Testament. Not the New Testament, obviously. It wasn't created yet, but they're not Christians. They're Jews. So they have the Old Testament. And they have the traditions of the oral law. And the oral law helps them define the law. Without the oral law, okay, thou shalt not commit adultery. Okay, how do we not commit adultery? Well, one argument was if you cover a woman head to foot so nobody can really see her, no man could commit adultery with her. Well, they didn't do that, but that was an argument. Right? You can't commit adultery if the men and women really can't see each other. This is why in the Jewish synagogue, the men and women didn't sit together. Part of the reason why is you can't be looking at each other, you know. We can't have the teenagers, of course, the girls usually married off at mid-teens. So you can't have your 14-year-old and the 19-year-old she's going to marry, or 20-year-old, looking at each other in services. So you sort of separate them. That way, no bad thoughts can happen. You can't have adultery. So you separated men and women in services. That's part of the oral law. The oral law was, how do we protect the law? If nobody will ever commit adultery, if we make enough laws that nobody can even get to adultery. Okay? So this was the reason why, is this paranoia. We can never go back into captivity again. And so you have the growth of the oral law. Now remember the Torah, it's the first five books of the Bible. But there's also the oral Torah. The oral Torah that's passed on from generation to generation within Judaism. Now, the Torah itself, or the scriptures, the written scriptures, to save the written scriptures, to keep it from generation after generation, is an enormous job. It's so difficult. How do you make... Okay. Let's go back to 200 BC. How many books are there? None. They're scrolls. And when they finally do make books, which are called codices or codex, primitive books, there's no mass printing. Every book, there's a guy with some ink and a quill. And he's taking the other book and he's writing it out. If you're writing Hebrew, you're writing the other way. You're writing it out this way. You ever see a Hebrew Bible? Genesis is at the back. And you don't read it like we do, left to right. You read it right to left. How many have ever seen Hebrew? It's fascinating. I can't even... The alphabet is beyond my imagination. Because it's not even... You know why? We have a Greek alphabet. Our alphabet's based on Greek. It's not entirely, but it's based basically on Greek. It's not based on Hebrew, not the English. So, what would they do? They had people professionally trained so that every so many years, when a scroll wore out, they would copy it by hand. If they made a mistake, they had to put a note at the bottom. You know, I misspelled this word. Oops, I spilt some ink, or my quill blotted there. Okay, right now. Okay, so I'm not adding an extra word here to the Bible. And we've got to make sure that we don't mess up the name of God. So we never spell out Yahweh. We just put a YHVH. Have you gone to any class talked about the Tetragrammaton? You know, okay, just YHVH. Why? Why do you just put... But we can't misspell God's name. We can't use His name in vain because we only write a few letters of it. Why? Oral law. Why? We're never going to use God's name in vain again. If you ask a Jew, how do you pronounce YHVH? We usually say Yahweh or Yahweh or Jehovah. It's pronounced all different ways in English. You know what they tell you? Ask a Jew that knows Hebrew, how do you pronounce YHVH? And they'll say, oh, we don't know. And we can't tell you. We can't say that. That's his sacred name. So the argument in English that we all have to figure out how to pronounce God's name is not a Jewish argument. They think it's ridiculous. The oral law won't let them do it. We can't use God's name in vain, so we can't even say his name. Now you start to understand the oral law. The oral law is so important. So the people who wrote these things down are called scribes. So all the time in the Bible you see scribes, right? Scribes and Pharisees. Why were the scribes there? Because, you know, this scribe, you know, his job was to keep writing down the book of Isaiah over and over again. And so if you wanted somebody to quote Isaiah, you look at him and say, what does Isaiah say? Not in Isaiah 2:15, because they did not have it in chapters and verses. They memorized the entire book. What does Isaiah say about this subject? And they would have to quote Isaiah from the middle of the book because they wrote it down. That's why scribes were always there in these arguments. Scribes are the ones who write the books down. They're the ones who keep track of everything. In the Jewish world, the greatest scribe is Ezra. He's mentioned in the Bible as being Ezra the scribe. So they consider him the greatest of the scribes. So what they decided to do, there's an interesting group of people that get together as they come out of the Babylonian captivity, and they're called the fathers. They actually wrote down some of their sayings. But one of the things they said they had to do, these people came out of the captivity, and they are the forerunners of the Pharisees, by the way. They're the ones who became the Pharisees, was that they had to build a hedge around the law. Once again, if the men and women don't sit together in services, we can't have any impure thoughts going on. So no adultery or fornication can happen after services. Okay? So we will make this law that make them, they can't sit together. The men worship and the women. That's why in Jewish services today, if it's a conservative, they might have a dance as part of their service. The men dance together and the women dance together. They don't dance holding hands together or dance together at all in services in the conservative or Orthodox world, because why? Well, there might be some impure thoughts going on. So we got to make sure that doesn't happen. So this hedge around the law had to be created. Let's go to Galatians 1. Because this is the world of the first century church. This is the world that Jesus comes along and teaches in. A world in which they don't understand. They built a hedge around the law. They built a hedge around the law to make sure they didn't go into captivity again. And what had happened to them? The Romans invaded, and they were in captivity again. Not in the same way. They weren't made slaves, but you know, they had to pay taxes. The Romans governed them. They couldn't govern themselves entirely. And it was like, God, we built a hedge around the wall. I mean, the law. And how could this happen? The conclusion was, the Messiah is coming. The Messiah is coming to free us. This is one reason why so many people follow Jesus. The whole society believed that the Messiah was coming. So you have to put yourself there to understand. We were taken back into captivity after building the hedge around the law. We protect the law. We make sure we don't break the law so God will never punish us again. Why are we being punished? Ah, the scriptures say, the prophets talk about how we will be oppressed and then the Messiah will come. So they're waiting for the Messiah to come. In Galatians 1:13, here's what Paul says. For you have heard of my former conduct in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy it. And I advanced in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries in my own nation, being more exceedingly zealous for the traditions of my fathers. Now, that's not the Ten Commandments. You know, I've heard people try to say, oh, the traditions of the fathers there is the Ten Commandments. So the Ten Commandments were given by God. They weren't considered the traditions of the fathers. The traditions of the fathers was the oral law. And how then you applied the written law. See, the oral law told you how to apply the written law. So you would study the oral law. Okay, this is how we now live by the written law. This is how we protect it. When you think about Jesus' arguments with the people of his day, Think about the arguments of Jesus with the people of his day. So many of it was about how they interpreted the law. The Sabbath, he's condemned as a Sabbath breaker over and over again. He talks about the Corban vow. We'll go through some of those things. Why? Why is Jesus arguing the law? Because that's what Jews did. They argued the law. And whenever you really needed an answer, you would say, well, Rabbi so-and-so said this. So you could have Peter saying, well, Rabbi Jesus says this. You could have Peter in an argument with some other Jews about the law. And a Pharisee would say, well, this is what Rabbi so-and-so says. And a Sadducee would say, well, this is what Rabbi so-and-so says. And Peter could say, well, this is what Rabbi Jesus says. And they would argue and argue and argue. Well, according to the oral law, see, the oral law fixed everything. This accumulation of traditions fixed everything. So I'm going to stop here for a minute and say, have I lost you already? Okay. I'm trying to tie this into some of the things you've already learned. Any questions? Yes.
I think this fits, or at least I'm hoping so. I was curious. I was thinking last night.
All right, I'm done with this. I was thinking last night about like Jewish history and like when did they start looking for a Messiah? And that, like, I know it's in the Old Testament scriptures, but clearly they weren't like, you know, Moses was not thinking, well, he's going to come here soon. You know,
right.
When did they start looking for him? And then what scriptures? Or maybe it's in like an oral law. Did they kind of get their logistical information of how that would work? Because Jesus came as, you know, a born child, and they said, well, that can't be it.
Right.
And I know they're looking for a conqueror, a savior, and all that stuff. Did they think he would come as a, like what we think of as a second coming?
Yes. Okay. Good question. He said, what was the Jewish viewpoint of the Messiah? And the anticipation of the Messiah grew. Once the Romans came, it really became a central point of their religion. I mean, they always knew there was a Messiah coming, but it seems to have been intensified. I mean, there's just all kinds of writings. Philo talks about it. There's all kinds of writings. They're anticipating him coming. And they're looking at Daniel, and they're saying, okay, first empire was Babylon. The second one was Persia. Third one was Greece. Rome must be the fourth one. They're looking and putting things together. When you look at Isaiah chapter 2, it talks about the Messiah coming in being the king. You look at other places in Isaiah where it talks about him coming, and he's a descendant of David, so they were looking for a physical man that would be from God, but a physical, in other words, they didn't see him coming like we do, because that's a description from New Testament, I mean, Thessalonians, Revelation, okay, that's a description from there. They're looking at a physical man who's going to come, overthrow the Romans, and establish God's kingdom on earth with them as the center of it. And there's prophecies in the Minor Prophets that talk about that. Ezekiel talks about it. In other words, they're taking all these prophecies. Okay, this man comes. They didn't know what to do with prophecies like Isaiah 52, 53, where God sends this suffering servant who's also an anointed one, which is what a Messiah means. And this anointed one dies, and his blood sprinkles the nations for their salvation. Some rabbi said, there's two Messiahs. One dies and one reigns. They didn't put all that together. That's something that grew from the New Testament, where we're able to say, oh, wait a minute, there's two comings. Okay. So they didn't understand two comings. So they were waiting for this man to come who would raise them up and overthrow the Romans. And so the intensity of messianic desire really was in that first century. I mean, they're still looking forward to this Messiah today, the Jews are. But I mean, it was there was false messiahs that would pop up all over the place, and there would be Jewish revolts. Oh, okay, let's get behind this guy. He's going to overthrow the Romans. And of course, they always got crushed. So when Jesus comes along, you're in a hotbed of messianic anticipation. Not just in Judea, but throughout the diaspora. Throughout the diaspora, they're waiting now. Yeah, the Jewish population was fairly substantial in the Roman Empire. The estimates are that there were 60 to 80 million people in the Roman Empire at its height, and there was probably 5 to 6 million Jews. That means they could have been 8 to 10% of the entire population of the Roman Empire, you know, depending on how you look at those figures. So you're looking at a substantial number of people with a strong influence because they're bankers and merchants, and wherever you go, there's a Jewish community, you know. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. So that happened for a long time. They had the teaching a long time before. It just intensified then.
It intensified.
But would that anticipation, I feel like it would have led to more acceptance of like, oh yeah, here he is, like 1,000 times over from all these false claims, right? So why was there not more acceptance of
Jesus?
Yeah.
We'll get into that when we get into the Jewish leaders, why they didn't accept that. So we'll actually have to get into that some. The average person was accepting it. It was growing. That's why they wanted to kill him. You think about him going into Jerusalem, and thousands of people come out, and they're praising him, and he's riding in on a donkey, which is a prophecy. And so why are all these thousands of people out there yelling and screaming? And because they think he's the Messiah. And it scared them, because they said, if he claims to be the Messiah, he's going to start an army and the Romans are going to come in and slaughter us. Which is what the Romans like, just be peaceful, make money and leave us alone. Be peaceful, pay your taxes and leave us alone. That was the Roman rule. But mess up and we kill all of you. Okay, it's a simple formula here. And they were afraid. You know, in the temple had a Roman garrison attached to it. There was a Roman fortress attached to it. That's why I remember Paul is a mob is going to kill him. I don't know if you're into that place in Acts yet, where they're going to kill him. He's in the temple, and this mob is going to kill him, and a bunch of Roman soldiers show up. Well, that's because there's a guard saying, they're at it again, you know, and all the march out there, and you get, you know, a couple squads, and you march out, and you grab the guy and march back into the fortress. Because, oh no, they're going to kill another person. And that's part of this messianic anticipation. We have to keep the temple pure so the Messiah will come back, because he's going to come back to the temple. So we'll talk more about this. So keep those questions in mind. You'll probably have more as we go through this. Anything else about what we've covered so far? See, that's a good question, because you're starting to think of continuity, not just events. History sees things as a continuity. Oh, this is one event, but there's all these other events around it. Unfortunately, you know how you're taught history? 1492. Yeah. Dates and people and major events. And you're not taught all the stuff that happened around those events. So what did it mean to the people? What did it mean to live there in that event? So this excitement, this is the world Jesus comes into. Well, this is interesting to talk about the written, the oral law. This is what Philo writes about the oral law. For the man who obeys the written laws is not justly entitled to any praise, inasmuch as he is influenced by compulsion and the fear of punishment. In other words, just to obey the Ten Commandments, anybody can do that. Gentiles can do that. But he who abides by the unwritten laws is worthy of praise, as exhibiting a spontaneous and unconstrained virtue. In other words, it was more righteous to keep the oral law than the written law. Anybody could not murder. Now, you're going to find some of these strains in Christianity. Jesus said, what? You have heard that it's wrong to murder. I'm telling you, it's wrong to hate. That argument, there's a lot of Jews who would say, yes, that's right. That's a Jewish argument. On the Sabbath, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself, because we'll get into some of the teachings of Jesus in this world that he lived in. His arguments are Jewish. Paul's not always Jewish. Paul has a lot of Greek arguments, because he was trained in both as a rabbi and a Greek philosophy. But Jesus, all his arguments are Jewish, because that's the world he came to. That's the world he lived in. That's where, you know, he knew where he came and why he was coming and what he was going to do, and he argued in that society. Sometimes we remove his arguments out and we misunderstand the world that he lived in. And then we find out why they wanted to kill him. Okay, we're going to move on now. I want to talk about Jewish history. So now they come out of Babylon, and I'll wrap this up here so we can take our break. They come out of Babylon, and they get resettled back in. And they do pretty, you know, they sort of do okay for a while. They don't really follow God the way they should. That's why you have like Malachi and, you know, these post-exilic prophets that are sent to them to say, hey, God says he brought you out of captivity. Why are you, you know, sort of wishy-washy about all this stuff? Well, it was after Malachi that you have these fathers. You have these guys that, okay, what we have to do is we have to really, really, really bring the law down into exact obedience. So somebody must have listened to Malachi. But they went to another extreme. But what happens is that in 332, Alexander the Great conquers Persia, and they come under the rule then of the Greeks. And remember the Ptolemies and the Seleucids? Have you heard those two names? Okay. So the Seleucids are the Greek families, the general in these families, that rule over Syria, and the Ptolemies over Egypt, right? And they keep fighting each other because they want to grab each other's territory. And for many, many, many years, they fight. Now, if you're in Syria and you're down here in Egypt, anyone know what's in between those two countries? What is it? Israel, that's right. So guess who's going back and forth across? You know, archaeologists in Israel, guess what they find a lot of? Greek coins, all kinds of Greek coins. Some have Ptolemies on them and some have Seleucids on them because they're going back and forth fighting each other and they're the center of all this stuff, all this fighting as they go back and forth. The Ptolemies ruled Egypt until the Romans. You've all heard of Cleopatra, right? Cleopatra was not Egyptian. She was Greek. She was one of the last of the top. Now, that she was like the fourth Cleopatra. I think she was Cleopatra the fourth. But the one who seduced Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. Okay, she was Greek. Now, she would have dressed like a Egyptian because she wanted to be worshipped. And they took up all Egyptian customs. But by this time, by the time of Cleopatra, Alexandria, Egypt, was more Greek than Athens. It was the center of Greek philosophy throughout much of the world. Why would that happen? Well, because Cleopatra and all of her, you know, predecessors weren't Egyptian. They were Greek. And they mixed Greek and Egyptian culture together. And that's going to be important later. So remember that too. It's going to be important later. So the Romans come in and they take over. Well, that you've probably heard a little bit about the Maccabees. I'm not going to go into that, but they're the ones who overthrew the Greeks, and then the Jews came under Roman rule in 63 BC. And there's a couple people to know here. Herod the Great, you'll see him mentioned in the Bible. He was a tyrant. That's why the Romans liked him being in charge. They put him in charge of much of what is now the Middle East around Israel. What Israel is, Syria. Jordan, all that area, Israel. He ruled over all that, Galilee. And he also was an enormous builder. He built Caesarea Harbor, which was an amazing feat. He actually built a harbor that wasn't a harbor, an artificial harbor. And in doing so, goods could come into Judea, not through caravans, but actually through ships. And it just, their wealth exploded. He remodeled Zerubbabel's temple. So the temple that you see Jesus and the disciples going to is a remodeled temple. It's a beautiful temple. Zerubbabel's temple wasn't near as beautiful as what Herod made it. So, you know, he made it one of the great wonders of the world at the time. And he also created Masada. Anybody know what Masada is? Masada is a fortress. I'll tell you why it's famous, and we'll end up with this, and then we'll take a break. Masada is a fortress on top of a mountain that in 70 AD, the Jews revolted, and they destroyed, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, And the last of them went, got in this fortress in Masada that he built, and the Romans couldn't take it. But the Romans being Romans, you talk about tenacious. The Romans were tenacious. They brought in at least one legion, at least 5,000 to 6,000 men from Rome, and said, guess what we're going to do? And they built a road. Now you think about a road going up a mountain. It has to start like a mile away, because you know, under fire from the Jews, because the Jews on top of this mountain had enough food and water to last for years. They built a road across the desert all the way up to the top of the mountain. And when they finally broke through, all the Jews were dead. They had committed mass suicide. And that was the end of the Jewish-Roman War of 70 AD. If you were an 18-year-old Jew in Israel today, you have to go into the army. And when you, after you go through your basic training, they take you to the top of Masada and you swear, this will never happen again. That's why the Israelis fight so hard. They swear, we will kill the enemy to the last man. We will die. We will never kill ourselves again. But we will never surrender. That's the viewpoint of their army. And they go to Masada and they swear that. So, there's Herod the Great's Masada, still is part of our world today, because that's where the Jewish soldiers go to swear their allegiance. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll get into Greek and Roman culture. Okay, we've gone through Jewish culture, we'll get into Greek and Roman culture. Quick things about the relationship between the Jews and the Romans. If you turn to page 12... in your book, because you think, okay, well, the Jews must have been a really unified religion in the first century. Well, they weren't. They were all kinds of Jewish groups, and they argued with each other all the time. And here's just a few. One, of course, these are the most famous, are the Pharisees. They had a very strict interpretation of the Torah and the oral law. A number of the Pharisees joined the church, or the group, because remember, the Jesus group is just seen as another Jewish sect. Pharisees accepted Jesus, some of them did, as the Messiah and entered into the church. And then what do we find? Arguments in the church that are Pharisaical. They come from the Pharisees. And Paul's dealing with, no, we can't make Gentiles be circumcised, and here's why. And the Pharisees say, well, yes, we are. The Bible says we have to, and the oral law says we have to. Now, you think, how would these Pharisees, why would they be saying this? Because they had become Christians. Then you have the Sadducees. They were basically, for the most part, they were either priests or from wealthy families. The Pharisees were very interesting. The Pharisees don't have a basis in the Old Testament as far as their organization or as a group. The Pharisees came from these fathers who wanted to build a hedge around the law. They weren't part of the Levites. The Levites were the ones God ordained to teach the law. The Pharisees were never ordained. They simply formed a party and said, the Levites don't do a good job. You know, even Malachi said they weren't doing a good job, so we're going to take over. And the Sadducees, who were basically Levites, said, oh no, we're the ones who are ordained. But the Pharisees had such power by this time, they sort of balanced each other out. There was a balance of power between these two groups, but they were always arguing. You know, when Jesus said, if your ox falls in the ditch, you get him out on the Sabbath, that's a Pharisaical argument. They didn't argue that one with him because the Essenes said no. The Essenes said only if people fall in the ditch. If your ox falls in the ditch, that's just, you just leave him there till sundown. So, you know, these groups argued these things just over and over again. You have the Herodians. Now, this was a political party. They followed the family of Herod. And they're not a religious party, but they are a political party. The Zealots, they are also a religious political party. Because the Zealots think that they're going to set up for the Messiah to come. And they are violent. They were always attacking Roman soldiers. And then you have the Essenes. The Essenes aren't mentioned in the Bible, But the Essenes were the strictest of the Jewish groups, and they're the ones who end up at Masada. They're the last holdout against the Romans, and they're the ones who end up killing themselves, hundreds of them, because they just won't surrender. So those are some of the groups, and there are other groups too, but these are the major groups. So you see they're divided politically, and they're divided by their interpretation. Also, the Romans did allow the Jews to govern them or their own affairs to a certain extent by letting them have the Sanhedrin, which comprised of 70 members and priests. It's very interesting. The Romans would come along and say, I don't like your priest, we're replacing him. Now, the Jews would say, you don't have the power to do that, but they couldn't stop it. So there are times the Sanhedrin has two or three high priests. And the reason why is the Romans removed one. Well, they didn't remove him. They added another one. They just said, okay, we have two high priests now. Because they weren't going to just let them remove high priests. You could keep adding to them, but you can't remove one. So sometimes it gets really weird in Sanhedrin history. It's like, wait a minute, there's more than one high priest? Well, yeah, because the Romans picked another one. And, you know, we didn't throw out the old one. But so they do have a certain autonomy. The Romans did not try to govern every place they went. Unless you rebelled. They kept rebelling. They kept rebelling in Judea. And that's why Pontius Pilate is sent there. It's taken away from one of the members of the Herodian family. And Pontius Pilate is sent there. And he's sent to Caesarea, which is named after Caesar. He's sent to Caesarea and he shows up with a legion. When they show up with a legion, 5,000 to 6,000 men, the Romans basically say, our 5,000 could beat your 10,000 any day of the week. When we show up with a legion, don't step out of line. We'll crush you. And which is what they normally did. So, also one other thing to know. In 1947, they found a bunch of scrolls in both Hebrew and Aramaic around Qumran. And these are called the Dead Sea Scrolls. And many of the writings of the Dead Sea Scrolls are attributed to the Essenes. And by the way, there is an entire section in there about the Messiah's coming. Okay, there's an entire section. See, they're looking for the Messiah coming. But it also contains copies of the Bible, parts of the Bible. Not the whole Bible, but parts of it. What's interesting, we can now look at scrolls written in Aramaic and Hebrew before the time of Jesus, and compare it to modern translations of the Hebrew Bible, and guess what? It's spot on. See, when you find older manuscripts, it's good, because remember, manuscripts for thousands of years were handwritten and passed on. So when you find one this old, and you say, wow, Isaiah, in the modern translation of Isaiah, you look at them, you translate it into English, or translate it, and it's like, wow. They're almost exactly the same. Usually what you have is misspelled words. Or occasionally a word that no one knows what it means anymore. So these ancient manuscripts are very important in helping us know, what we have, especially of the Old Testament, is spot on. Okay, now we're going to get into Greek history. Because you can't separate what's happening in the first century, and you can't separate what happens in the formation of the early church without understanding Greek culture too. If you turn to your book to page 29, here's a handful of famous Greek people. And I'll answer it now before anybody brings it up, because it comes up every year. Homer. No, his last name was not Simpson. Okay? Do they still make The Simpsons, or is it finally canceled? Is it still on? Man alive. It's lasted a generation. Homer, no one knows anything about Homer. It's just a name that's attached to the Iliad and the Odyssey. Have any of you read the Iliad or the Odyssey? You have? Wow, I have not. I have watched about 20 years ago. They did a great, BBC or something, did a great miniseries on the Odyssey where they tried to exactly, reproduce what's in the book. I watched that, so I didn't have to try to read the Odyssey. I understand the themes of it, but Homer's very important because these two pieces of literature establish really outside of the Bible, the basis of what was going to become Western culture. Western culture is based on two things: the Hebrew Bible and Greek culture. And that's what formed Europe, and that's what helped form the United States. Those two things. So Homer's important. You have some others here. Pythagoras. Anyone know what Pythagoras is famous for? It's the one Greek person you've probably heard of. Anybody know? That's right. Pythagorean theorem, which is what, two in a triangle, whatever it is. I can't remember. You remember what it was? Based, yes, yeah. Yeah. So you put it in the algebraic form and now we got it. Okay. Bring it down to simple algebra instead of trying to, you know. Well, the thing about Pythagoras, he actually had a religion that was based on mathematics. He saw the gods as creating everything, and mathematics was how you understood the universe. It's how you understood things. It was sort of this science of creation was mathematics. So he brings in a scientific understanding a philosophy. Pericles, he was important because he was a general and a statesman who led Athens at its golden age. You have Herodotus. Herodotus is famous. Now you probably also have Herodotus, a copy of Herodotus back in the library. Herodotus was a Greek historian. He's considered the first great historian. Reading his writings are interesting because it's sort of a mixture of history, myth. He would travel all over and he would get the history and myths of that country and write it down. It's sort of like a travel log. I mean, he's like a travel writer. And everybody loved his book because it was like, wow, this is fascinating. He goes to Egypt and he tells us about their history and about their gods. But you don't know what's true and what's not true half the time. But he's a travel writer mainly. But he's considered the father of Western history because it's the first real history book we have outside of the Bible. And of course, the Bible is in this very narrow culture at this time. Then you have Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, which are extremely important. We're going to talk about Plato specifically. Alexander the Great, Zeno, there's others too, but Alexander the Great's important too. What happens here is around in the early 400s BC, we have something new happening in Greek culture. The Greek world is made up of city-states. You have Corinth and Sparta and Athens and Thessalonica, and they are cities. And there's big farmland, little towns around these cities, but that is a central government. All the people around Athens, if you asked, where are you from? Well, I'm from Athens. If you asked them if they were Greek or Hellene, they'd say, from Athens. Where are you from? I'm from Sparta. Well, I'm from Corinth. In other words, that was their country. They had a common language, and there were certain things common in their culture, but they didn't see themselves as Greeks. They saw themselves as these independent city-states. And two of these city-states really grew in two different directions, but they helped create a common Greek culture. One was Athens. Athens began to create a new kind of government called a democracy. New kind of government called a democracy. Now, their democracy was you had to be a male citizen. Women couldn't vote and slaves couldn't vote, but males who were citizens could vote. That was a brand new idea. People get to vote. So they would assemble regularly, sometimes up to once a week. All the citizens would assemble, and they would take votes. And they had another smaller group that had to vote because there were so many of them after a while, they couldn't make decisions. There's one Greek word you all know. You know a couple Greek words. Anyone want to guess what the assembly of the Greek citizens was called? Assembly of Greek? In Greek. ecclesia. You ever heard that one? It's what the church is called. The ecclesia in Athens was all the citizens got together. And they would assemble together, and you were required to come. Athens grew in with art and literature. I mean, they created plays, tragedies, and comedies, and they created sculpture that was greater than any sculpture in precise and beauty ever created, probably by anybody before that. Yes.
I was just curious, like if they were all so separate, then how would they understand when Paul says, to the Jews I became as a Jew, to the Greeks I became as a Greek?
We'll get into that. Okay. Did you hear the question? How come, if they're separate, why in the New Testament are they referred to as common, collective? They became collective. I mean, they became common. We have to work through this a little bit. So, Athens has this great time of democracy. And in this democracy, they create an economic system. Now, they don't know what to call economic systems. I mean, they don't have, like we have today, we call it capitalism, socialism, and communism. They just created an economic system that said, if you can make money, make money. And guess what? They did. Because they became shipbuilders. And they created little trading posts all over the Mediterranean. In fact, their trading posts sometimes became places where they set up colonies. And all of a sudden, all this wealth was just flowing into Athens. Sparta, on the other hand, became a nation of warriors. Now, the Athenians also had a strong army because every city-state had to have its own army. In fact, the problem with the Greeks at this time period is that every summer, someone would go pick a fight with one of the other city-states and they have a little war. Not a big one. You don't want to kill off all your soldiers. You have a little war. Once a few guys die, one side would say, I give up. Pay us some money, and they'd all go home. So the problem with the Greek city-states are always having little wars with each other. Well, Sparta decided they were going to win every war. And what Sparta designed was a pure warrior culture. At 12 years old, mama turned you over to go to military school. And you were told, you were given a shield by mom, and she said, when you go out to battle, when you come home, you either come home victorious or on your shield. Because that's how they carried back their dead. They laid them on their shield and they carried them back. So mama said, you go to battle, if you don't come home if you lose, you die first. It was a tough world. To be a Spartan meant that you were basically beat up from the age 12 to about 18. You were constantly in a school where you had to fight every day with clubs, fake knives, fake spears, and it's not unusual that some of them would die because it was okay. If the weak died, that was good. In fact, in Sparta, if you had a baby that was born, it was sickly, you'd just throw it away. Boys, specifically. In Sparta, all the men were bisexual because you were expected to have a woman, a wife at home that you'd go back and make babies with. But to make sure that you were bonded to your brothers, you had sex with your brothers. Okay? The reason Sparta eventually died out as a city-state is they would not lose. There's only so many battles you can fight where every soldier dies. What's Thermopylae famous for? The Battle of Thermopylae, where the Spartans... Well, there were other Greeks there too. The Spartans just get the spotlight here. It's not fair to the other Greeks. But, you know, the 300 Spartans did what? Did anybody see the movie 300? I haven't seen it, but what happened to the Spartans? The Persians invaded. They held a pass. And for the rest, and there were as many as anywhere between, they estimate 250,000 to 1,000,000 Persians. And they held a little pass, so they had to come down in little groups. They held the pass and died to a man so that the entire Greek army could escape. And the Spartans thought, wow, this is so cool. They all died. And they piled the bodies up. I mean, the Persians, they killed thousands of Persians. They just piled the bodies up, but they died killing as many people as they could. This is Spartan thought process. Now, the Athenians are like, let's make money. Let's create things. Okay, so you have these two cultures forming. They eventually merge into one, which is we create things. We have music. We create music. We create architecture. You think of the Greek architecture that's still famous for today. Corinthian columns, okay, that are still used today. All these things got mixed with, yeah, but we're good soldiers too. And then you have the Greek Empire. And what happened was, Alexander the Great, who was a Macedonian, and they also spoke Greek, basically went to the Greeks and said, I'm going to go off and conquer the world. You're going to want to go with me? And at first, some of them didn't go. He said, okay. And eventually, he's like, well, he's conquering the world. So a little Greek army went with him, and he went off and conquered the entire Persian Empire with about 30,000 men, which is unbelievable. Because of the phalanx. They marched in straight lines, highly trained, and the front three lines had spears 20 feet long. You can imagine something marching towards you, and it's a wall of spears. And then they would run. And they turned a 5,000-man phalanx into a giant tank. And they would run until they ran over the other army and trampled them. You did not want to be in the middle of a phalanx and fall down, because your own men just ran over you, because everybody's running forward. And that worked for a couple hundred years until the Romans came along and said, hey, we'll just go around you. And they went around them and attacked them from the rear, and you can't get all the spears turned around this way, and that's how the Greek Empire fell. But anyways, I digress, okay? They have things like public schools where you learn philosophy and mathematics and science. First time anyone had that kind of concept. Are you used to that? How about the idea that the mind and body have to both be developed together? So everybody has to learn sports. In fact, every 4 years, all wars among city-states had to stop. And they got together for the Olympic Games. Ever heard of that? There's so many things in our culture, even our alphabet is based on the Greek alphabet, that comes from the Greek world. Public baths, the fact that you should be clean, you shouldn't go around dirty all the time. There were just all kinds of new ideas. And that people have a responsibility to create things. Music, art, this is part of our society. They also had... When they wanted to find out what the gods believed, because they believed in all these gods, starting with Zeus, was the chief god, they would go to oracles. There's an oracle that at Delphi, which was the most famous oracle, and she would tell you things like, should I invest this money? And she would go into a trance, and then she would say something like, it is never a good idea to waste what you have. Which means nothing. And people go and say, oh yes, I should invest it. And others would go, no, I shouldn't. And they say, wow, she's so smart. Well, they found out why she was always in a trance now. They've excavated Delphi. And the temple was built over a fault line. And underneath of it, there's all this, I think it's methane gas that seeps up all the time. She was high all the time. You know, she just babbled. That's all she knew. I mean, she couldn't even understand what she was saying. So... But for a long, long time, the Greeks listened to the Oracle of Delphi. In this time period of this great epoch in the 400s BC of Athenian time, there is something new formed called philosophy. Now, I mean, Pythagoras was before this. They had philosophers. I mean, they always great thinkers, okay? Great thinkers who thought about things. But you have something new come along with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle that they systematically decide we can figure out how to see the world. We can understand how everything works. We can understand how this all fits together. Plato's very important, and I'm going to just tell you one aspect of his teaching because I think it comes up later. It comes up hundreds of years later in Christianity. Okay, so I mean, I don't recommend reading lots of Plato. I mean, you could try to get through the Republic, but Timaeus, I tried to read. I agree with one modern scholar who says he thinks he was insane when he wrote it. I mean, it makes a sense translated into English, but There are a couple things about Plato that became central to his philosophy, that became central to the way people thought for hundreds of years. So we'll see why in a little bit. Plato came up with the idea that there is a one. He just called him the one. No one's not sure exactly what he meant. I mean, he didn't bring it out in great detail, but there's this one. And this one is genius, and this one is eternal, and this one is spirit. Now, later Platonic philosophers, because there's a whole school of Platonic philosophers that went for about 500 years, they would refine this into that there is one God. There's one God, an unknown God, an unknowable God that is so amazing, but we know him because of what he's done. So Plato says, in the mind of this one God are the archetypes. In other words, it's like a horse. When you and I look at a horse, we're looking at a physical thing. In the mind of this God, in this place, if you could somehow be with this one, you could see what he sees. And what he has in his realm is the perfect horse made out of spirit. Absolute perfect horse. And it lives forever. And in his world, in this place, it's not a world, it's everything. But, you know, it's in the mind of this one, there's the perfect tree and the perfect dog and the perfect human being. Everything exists because he thought it. And when he thought it, there it was. But then there comes along what he called the demiurge. Now, at first it seems like the demiurge is the one, but as you go on, he doesn't seem to be one. He seems to be someone else. Later Greek philosophers, Platonic philosophers would say, no, the demiurge isn't the one. The demiurge must be something he created with a thought. Demiurge means craftsman. Now think about this. You have the one, and then you have a craftsman. Matter has always existed for Plato, and it was in chaos. And the craftsman takes the matter, and he works with it, and he begins to make things out of it. And you guess what he does? He knows what's in the mind of the one, so he creates copies. He can't create the perfect horse. It exists in the mind of one and of the one in its spirit. So he creates copies. Horses that die. Horses that aren't perfect. He creates human beings that die, that get sick. They're not perfect. But they're copies of the perfect man and the perfect woman who exists in the mind of the one. So if you could be in with him, you would see all these perfect things. So the demiurge does this. You think, well, why in the world do I have to know that? Because this concept affects the formation of Christianity in the second and third century. You think, how could it do that? I want you to think about one thing. I don't want to go there yet. What does Paul say in Colossians? That God, the great God, created all things through Christ. Now, if I'm trained in Greek philosophy, the first thing I think is, the one and the demiurge. Now, that's not what he means. It's a different viewpoint. But that if you're trained in Greek philosophy and you're reading the Bible in Greek, you're thinking, I understand this. So once we get into the second century, we have a whole new set of problems being brought into Christianity that they weren't dealing with in the first century very much because, well, they weren't dealing with Greek philosophy. But we find a real problem with that. So you need to understand that little bit about Plato. He also believed in the immortal soul, by the way. Plato believed in the immortal soul, and he believed that the purpose of being a human being, you were created and you messed up, so you ended up in a body, and you have to go through this body to learn how to get back home to God, to the One. And if you don't do very good, he simply lets you die, and he puts you in another body, And this is where reincarnation entered the Western world. Went from the Eastern world into the Western world. So reincarnation became part of the thought process of the Western world for a long time. You just get reincarnated. So immortal soul, the one unknowable God, and the demiurge. Remember those three things. Because this was central to Greek philosophy. You do find a few... I talked about the demiurge. By the way, that's where then many of the students of Plato said, oh, that's where Zeus came from. They're all created gods. The one unknowable being that nobody knows anything about, he created the gods. That's why there were certain Greek philosophers who demons and angels weren't hard to accept. Ah, those are just the gods. There's good gods and there's bad gods and they're just demons and angels. Seems the same, but it's not. Okay, we have to understand it seems the same, but it's not. But it's going to change what happens sometimes in Christianity. Now there are two in Acts 17:18. Acts 17:18. Let's see, this goes to what? 10:20? Okay, I'm not going to turn there. In Acts 17:18, there are two Greek philosophies mentioned. The Stoics and the Epicureans. And there were all kinds of branches of Greek philosophy. I mean, Plato wasn't the only one. He became the dominant one for hundreds of years. Well, the Stoics believed that the key to life was discipline. That you had to live in harmony with nature, and that everything was about exercising self-control so that you would control your emotions. Everything in life was learning to control your emotions so that you could live a serene life. Now, you might have to go to war. I mean, they weren't, you know, but you would do so because of a righteous reason, not because you were just angry. Everything was about controlling emotions. And so meditation was a big part of their religion. Marcus Aurelius, anybody see the movie Gladiator? Remember Marcus Aurelius in there? He was actually a Stoic. He was a Stoic philosopher. You can buy his meditations. I have a copy at home. Please borrow it. Don't buy it. You can buy his meditations if you want to try to wade through that junk, but he's a Stoic philosopher. Okay, I've read maybe two pages. Okay. But I use it for research. Then you have the Epicureans. The Epicureans were the opposite. They said the secret to happiness is find out anything that makes you feel happy. But the problem is sometimes you can do something that makes you feel happy, but then there's a bad consequence. So the whole thing in life was to find out what makes you happy but doesn't have any bad consequences. So life is a party. Getting drunk probably is not good. Drinking wine is. Getting drunk is bad. So life's sort of a party and having a good time, but knowing what your limits are. Where the Stoics are, you should not party at all. You should learn to control yourself. Okay. So they're actually mentioned in the Bible. You have two Greek philosophies mentioned in the Bible. Now, we know that Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire and actually took it as far as the Indus River. And what Alexander the Great did was he spread Greek culture wherever they went. His army was so small that when he conquered the Persian Empire, I'm jumping back a little bit because I want to show you how this all starts to mix together now. He took concepts of Plato and, Plato. He took concepts of Plato and he took... Greek art, Greek literature, Greek music, Greek architecture. And wherever he went, he set up schools and left some Greeks behind to teach them about Greek, the Greek language. Okay? And so he goes, because he united them. Yes, how they got united. He united them. And now they begin to see themselves as Hellenes instead of just members of certain cities or Greeks. That's why you'll see the word Hellenization. Hellenization means to convert somebody to Greek culture. You Hellenize them. They become Greek. So now they're Hellenes. We are Greeks. We see ourselves as Greeks under Alexander the Great. And they go around and they conquer the entire Persian Empire. And wherever they go, they can't set up an administration. I mean, the Persians actually ran an empire. They set up an administration. They could do that. They didn't have enough people. So what they did was they leave a small group of people behind and they said, teach them about being Greek. And that's why you will find Greek myths and Greek culture in little elements all through India, because they got to the end of into India and they finally stopped because the soldiers said to Alexander the Great, we're not going any farther. We don't even know where we are. We're so far from home, and every place we conquer, we destroy the army with our phalanx, and then we leave a few guys behind and we move on. You know, we're looting everything we have. We already have as much gold as we can carry. Why are we doing this? And so they just revolted and they had to go back to Greece. This is important in a number of ways. Because what happens in the New Testament? What language is most of the New Testament written in originally? What was the New Testament? What's the language that most of the New Testament was written in? Greek. Why? The Romans speak Latin. The Jews speak Aramaic or Hebrew. Aramaic being the common language. Of all the languages throughout the empire, why are Greek? Because wherever you could go, would go in the Roman Empire, somebody spoke Greek. Because, we're going to explain why in a little bit, the Greek culture was absorbed by the Romans on purpose into their empire. So Alexander the Great goes around and every place he goes. Now all through the Persian Empire, if you go into many towns, there is a synagogue. There is a synagogue. And Greek becomes the language of the synagogue. The Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek. We'll talk about that a little bit too, called the Septuagint. Paul goes all over the Roman Empire. And every place he goes, he doesn't speak Latin, by the way. We know he speaks Aramaic. We know he speaks Hebrew. We know he speaks Greek. He doesn't speak Latin. And every place he goes, people gather around him and listen to him. And I can guarantee you, when he goes to Ephesus or Corinth, or he goes to Thessalonica, okay? Ephesus too. When he goes to these places, I guarantee you they're not speaking Aramaic. Why does everybody understand him? Because they know more than one language. How many of you have been to Europe? Isn't it amazing every place you go that people speak English? They speak German, they speak French, they speak Italian, but they also speak English. Why? English is the language of commerce, right? The language of commerce inside the Roman Empire was Greek. If that hadn't happened, there was no way to get the gospel to the world. Hebrew wasn't going to get the gospel to the world. Latin wasn't going to get the gospel to the world. Aramaic wasn't going to get the gospel to the world. But you could go any place in the Roman Empire, and people spoke their language, and they knew Greek. That is an amazing miracle. That is an amazing miracle, that what we have is a language that connects people together. The easiest language today to preach the gospel in is English. We have a unique tool. If I was talking to you in what's the Scandinavian language? Norwegian? It wouldn't do much good, except in Norway. I only met a couple people in my life who could speak Norwegian. They lived in Wisconsin, okay? And their name was Sven, and they spoke Norwegian. But they also spoke English, right? So Greek now is spread throughout the empire. I'm trying to decide how much to get into Roman culture. I got 2 minutes. I'm going to stop here. Because what happens is that about 140 BC, the Romans conquer Greece. And when they do, they fall in love with the Greek culture. And they loot the entire country. I mean, they just take everything. They take it off to Rome, and they make Greek the language of academia. In fact, Horace, one of the great Roman philosophers and poets, said, "Captive Greece took Rome captive." You knew if you were a wealthy person, if you had Greek architecture in your house, or if you had some Greek sculptures. So now, not only have they Hellenized all over the place where the Persian Empire was, the Greek or the Roman Empire itself becomes Hellenized, Rome itself, as they bring the culture in to Rome. So next time, we're going to talk about the Roman culture, which is both distinctively Roman and Hellenized, and how those things interact with the first century church and then what happens beyond. Okay, well, I can't give you any more in 2 hours without having your heads explode, so any quick questions? I know you all have to go, but okay. Well, I'll be around if you have some questions or you want comments you want to make, so...